Alan Kring Productions, in association with the Emergent Light Studio, presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, for spring semester 2022. Today, Ethics, Part 1. This is part of a two-part series of lectures. There is a will be a PowerPoint presentation provided in your resources tab that covers the aspect of this ethics sequence having to do with agency. Before I do that, though, to say the typical look at the numbers, and I'll also say a few other things about other matters as well. Now, we finish up the material in this week and a little bit next week, and then we are in the phase of the course where we are reviewing for the final exam. And the final exam for this class, I believe, is Wednesday, 7:50 to 9:50 a.m. Yeah, 7:50 to 9:50 a.m. So, good times. And don't fuss at me. I don't set this schedule. The other section is on Tuesday from 7:50 to 9:50. If you want to be an early go-getter, you have to tell me that you're going to take it then. If otherwise, Wednesday will be fine for all of us. And don't come in your pajamas, for heaven's sakes. Okay, anyway. Quick look at the markets. This is an interesting thing that's happened today. Notice that the Dow is up more than 1%, then the S&P 500 is up just a little bit, 0.33%, and the NASDAQ is down 0.75%. That is kind of that obviously follows the pattern in reverse of risk and return, but good heavens, whatever the good news is today, it was great news for big, huge companies. It was sort of good news for the large cap 500, but it was bad. The news was kind of taken as being sour for little companies. One thing that I read, there's all kinds of explanations for why the markets do what they do, but there is a sense that companies that are involved in military and industrial types of industries are benefiting quite a bit these days from the war in Ukraine and from increasing production capacity, or increasing capacity needs in production. So that explains why you would see the bigger companies benefiting more. Now, notice that crude oil has taken a dive. Dipped below, I think it got below $100 a barrel there, and it's recovering here in the last 20-30 minutes, but there is a lot of oil out there floating around waiting to get into ports right now and get refined. So we may not get that gasoline jump that I was thinking about a few days ago, but it'll get back up there eventually. Now, looking over here really quickly at gold and silver, they took a fall today. Remember last time we were looking at them, they were up. And that was a strong indication that there was investing money flowing into them. But that has turned around right now. The 10-year bond is down 5 basis points in yield, so that means that the 10-year bond is up. That means money is going into bonds. Investors are putting money into bonds. They're not putting money into metals, but they're definitely putting money into big stocks, the safer stocks. They're not throwing money at risky stocks. The NASDAQ would be going up if investors were investing in equity in stocks of riskier companies. This is money moving toward equities, but moving toward the bigger companies and the safer, in that regard, companies. So there's that part of it. Looking over here just really quickly at the yield curve, it is really moving up hard. We still have that inversion. Yep, there's a 7-10-year inversion right there. See, the 7 is 2.95, the 10 years, 2.93. But overall, look at how these rates are really coming up along the, from the 1 year, the two, three, all of them are really rising. That indicates that what I was showing you about the Fed on Monday, that's really taking a biting in now as the interest rates are responding to the Fed clawing back the overhang of liquidity. The Fed is very serious about getting this under control. Just a brief mention. What I was telling you, the Federal Reserve can buy and sell treasury bills in open market operations. That's its big thing for manipulating the money supply and therefore interest rates. Well, interestingly enough, the Fed had gone beyond just buying and selling treasury bills. It was actually, to add money to the economy over the last few years, it was actually buying corporate paper as well. In other words, it wasn't just buying government debt to put money into the stream of the economy. It was buying private debt to build up the money supply to keep us from sliding into a recession. And those are generically, when the Fed does things like that, when it is really pouring money into the economy, they use this kind of euphemism, this term called quantitative easing, QE. Have any of you ever heard that term, QE, quantitative easing? Yeah, that's what they're doing. They're just pouring money into the economy, buying whatever they can, printing money, literally printing money, and then just buying debt. Usually they buy government debt. But they were going to the point where their balance sheet was swelling up with corporate stuff too. High quality, high grade, not junk bonds or anything like that, I don't think. And they were doing some other things, too, that are kind of exotics. There's something called a repo, or repurchase agreements, that they were doing, too. But all of that is coming to an end. The candy store is closed now. Those numbers you're seeing there are the actual visible evidence that what I showed you on Monday is in action. The draining of liquidity from the federal funds pool, which means that banks don't have as much money to lend out, so that, and the supply of funds is going down, so the price of funds, interest rates is going up. The whole chain of events is in play and it's happening. This is probably what will eventually throw us into a recession, or at least into an economic pause. Interest rates going up, present value, future expected cash flows goes down. People don't borrow as much for homes. They don't borrow. Companies don't borrow as much for capital improvements. So there you are. About when you guys will be going out there looking for jobs, I should say. Oh, goody. Yes, yes. I know you're excited about that. Enough of that, though. I'm going to talk a little more about that in ethics part two on Friday. There's some things that cross into this territory. Let me give you the motivation behind this ethics lecture. First of all, it begins very generally in a broader sense. And then it begins to focus down on business and finance. And at the end of it, it culminates in one of the most fundamental principles in business and in law and in finance. Interestingly enough, I have found out that this isn't taught in any course here in the business school. And it just blew me away when I found out that, when I said, have you heard of this? I got, no, I haven't heard of that. And so this is where it has to be done in my course. Thank God you've got me as your teacher. What was I going? Oh, but this begins broadly in philosophy of all things. But from philosophy, we get down to the business end of it relatively quickly. But the state right here, has a requirement that we teach ethics in our college, in our school. Which is kind of hilarious when you think about Illinois mandating ethics. The legislature of Illinois and our governors saying, thou shalt teach ethics. Well, my God, you're going to come to my class and you'll be shocked, I swear. I mean, this is considered the most corrupt state in the nation. And it has that history well deserved, and it just keeps earning that over and over again. From corrupt governors to corrupt power brokers in Springfield, this is a corrupt state. But I am supposed to teach you people how to be ethical. Narcissistic personality disorder, who has other people do his work for him. A few years ago, Elon Musk, popping off his mouth in his hateful way, called a first responder a hero who had helped save people who were trapped in a mine. He called that man a pedophile. And then what he did was that man sued him, so Elon brought all of his powerful attorneys and all of his money and destroyed the man in court. There's your ethical kind of guy. Bill Gates, a hero, an icon of business success. Well, his career at Microsoft began with Windows. Well, didn't begin, but it peaked and went on to great things from Windows. Now, what Bill Gates and his team of top people did was they called all the computer manufacturers and they said, you need to stop putting DOS, which was the operating system, on computers, new computers, and replace it with this new thing I've got called Windows. Now, that's illegal to do that. You can't do that, what he did. But the bet was, look, we're going to do it. Who cares about antitrust laws? Even if they prosecute us, by the time they do so, we will be so wealthy, so powerful, that we will not be hurt. And they were right. He went on to install Internet Explorer, an abominable browser, and it wiped out a company that had pioneered web browsers in the 1990s, a company called Netscape, and its browser, Netscape Navigator, destroying the innovators and badly ripping off their design standards. And there you are. Then he went on with later version of Windows and pre-installed a word processor called Word, which then destroyed the one that people bought called Word Perfect, which had been the standard for years. All of these were illegal actions. And I can tell you that because Microsoft admitted to it in its consent decree of US v. Microsoft 2000 in the year 2000. Yeah, we did it. And okay, here's what we're going to do to fix it. Well, they never did all the things they agreed to, like break Microsoft into two companies. Never did it. Why didn't they do it? Because the government was too weak to try to stop them. First from what they did, and then from violating the agreement flowing from the case, US v. Microsoft. Steve Jobs. Steve Jobs, the whole thing about that Mac user interface, that was a ripoff from a graphical user interface that had been developed some years before by Xerox Corporation. Steve Jobs went on to show what a scumbag he was from one end to the other. He would park every day in a handicapped parking spot at his office, and then he had so much money, he just had someone pay the fine for him every day. His career as a scumbag peaked when he, needing a new liver, used money to get to the front of the line and get a liver before some kid who needed a liver. Yeah, these are the kinds of people who are our icons. George Soros, a billionaire, the love child of liberal causes. His peak of his career was when he could have worked with the Bank of England to keep the economy and the bank from collapsing, but instead he did what probably was one of the most dramatic moves. He said, go for the jugular. You see, England had been trying to hold to an agreement it had with Europe on exchange rates, even though it was killing England doing it. So Soros knew that eventually England was going to have to give up. He could have helped the transition, but instead he took a position that literally wiped the books pretty badly on the Bank of England and sent England into a massive recession. And a recession that lost people jobs, families broke up, people died from sicknesses they couldn't afford to fix. There was even whispers of the king returning, that's King Cholera. It got so bad, but George Soros was a hero. He made $2 billion in one day, because he told his lackey, go for the jugular, instead of saying, call the Bank of England's exchequer and let's see what we can do. These are the people that are the icons of business. So this is this context in which I am teaching you ethics. I can tell you this is how you should behave, but you know damn well, you're not stupid, you know damn well that this is not how business works. Cheating is the way you win, realistically in many circumstances. And if you know anything about me, you know that I don't bullshit you. But I do give you a framework. Like I said, I give you a framework in which you can begin to act some more ethically, but by rules of the game and play those to the advantage of everyone involved, even though some people might not like it sometimes. But to do that, we have to look at what were the possible ways that you could frame proper action, moral action, if you were, or ethical action. You can go back, you can go back to the ancient times, to the codes of laws and conduct from the ancient civilizations and societies, but we can start it in maybe the 1600s with a fellow named Immanuel Kant. His proposal was called the categorical imperative. Now, understand, one reason that I start here is because we were coming to the Age of Enlightenment and we stopped taking God out of the equation. Not whether or not you believe in this God, this Messiah, or that prophet, let's take that out of the equation if we can and talk about an action that would be more of a universal. We could all agree regardless of what our religious leanings are. So Immanuel Kant laid out something called the categorical imperative. And it was very simple. It sounds like the golden rule, but it's not. Always act in the way, and this is a summary of it, in the way that you would want others to act. This is a kind of the philosophy people would yell at me, well, that's not exactly. Well, yeah, it is. In other words, this is the categorical imperative. It sounds like the golden rule, but it's not. The golden rule is do unto others as you would have them do unto you. No. This is a little bit more than that. It's saying you should always behave. If you want other people to do right, you do it yourself. If you want other people to do this, you do that. And so this laid out, notice that it is not a religious statement. There's no God in this. There's not even a moral statement in this. It's just clearly always do what you expect. Now, that it's called categorical because you always do it this way. There's no slippage in here. Well, we come a little bit later into the 1800s. Well, there was a lot of activity in the 1700s, philosophical trends moving toward what we consider modern conservatism, philosophical trends that we would now consider modern liberalism. But we get into the 1800s, and we got into something that was not categorical. We got into what we could call situational ethics. Now, there were actually a couple of different strains in this. Now, situational ethics can take one track that was done by John Stuart Mill's, or we can take another track, which was more Bellamy, a guy named Bellamy. You don't need to know these names, but do know what's behind this. Now, the Mill's approach, you could break it down, you could summarize it, the greatest good for the greatest number. This is actually kind of the basis of a democracy, the greatest good for the greatest number. Let me try one here. You, madam, you are in charge of PR and final decision-making that you send to PR on new drugs that are being developed. And you've gone through a number of clinical trials, and for this drug that is to save children's lives from a disease. Now, your child who has this disease has a life expectancy of about a year. This drug will ensure that they live complete lives. And you've gotten through the trials, and you're going to make the announcement the next morning. We have it. And then this sourpuss comes to you, research clinician. She says, actually, no. One out of every 100 children is killed within 2 weeks by this drug. The other 99 live complete lives, but one is killed by the drug within a couple of weeks. So what do you do? Shoot her. What do you do? Do you make the announcement and go forward or not? Your call. You wouldn't. You wouldn't go forward. What's going to happen to the shareholder's stock price? Go down like to hell and beyond. It's going to go down. What is your duty to the corporation? To maximize stockholder wealth, right? So in other words, you're saying that you're going to violate your duty to the shareholders to save that one miserable little kid, right? Except what happens if that's your kid? Yeah. You see, here's where the moral dilemma comes in. This greatest good for the greatest number? Yeah, racists love that. Yeah, we're the white majority. Let's take those other people down. Let's take down the minority of the LGBTQ plus community because they're the minority. You see, this works and it sounds great until it doesn't. Bellamy took it much more situationally. Look at the damn context. Look at the context and make your decision from there. This has the problem, though, that it doesn't give you a clear guideline. It doesn't give you a clear guideline. And it also, what is wrong with saving 99 kids to kill one? Some people would not agree with the idea that we've got to save one single child. So the problem here is that no matter how you cut it, you're going to have a problem with ethical frameworks that come from philosophical foundations, no matter how you play it in this. This thing, always act in the way that you would want others to act. Oh, sure, we all... Have you ever been driving along and you see all the cars in front of you flying past you and all of a sudden their brake lights come on? Well, that's not because they found Jesus. It's because they saw a cop up the road. Most people will violate the law whenever they feel like they can. That's the reality of it. So what is this, always act in the way that you would want others to act? Yeah, and they'll get plowed over by some truck behind you. Always act in the way that you would want others to act. Well, the Ukrainians certainly don't want the Russians to be bombing the hell out of them, so we certainly don't want the Ukrainians bombing the hell out of the Russians, do we? This is the problem with these situational, these ethical philosophies, is that none of them gives us a realistic way to address the problems of our lives. And especially in a world where we do have to appreciate minority rights because you look down the road and maybe that minority is going to be the majority someday. And then we would certainly want them to follow the categorical imperative. But we should probably bet that they won't because we didn't, so why should they? Why should we expect our children to behave in a way that is right when they see us not acting right? And we don't. And they're not stupid. They can see it. You know very well that's the case. Okay, so where am I taking this? I'm taking it to this place here where we get down to the problem of can we find a framework that may not be perfect, but it will work. And we're not going to try to solve the problems of society or human nature, but we do have a duty as business people to have a framework that works within the business environment, that gives us a way forward. Now I have to bring up a couple of things that I used to think you were taught in law classes, and I hear everywhere that I've taught. And it turns out that I used to teach business law, legal environment of business classes, and I would cover them, but apparently that's not very normal. A couple of minor issues along the way that I need to make sure you understand. Actual versus constructive knowledge. Actual versus constructive knowledge. And let me give you a case, I thought this was just one that didn't ever actually happen, but we talk about it in business ethics, business law classes, but it actually did. I researched it. It really did happen. And this goes to quite a few years ago. There was a used car dealer, and if I'm not mistaken, it was in a large city not far from here. Sold used cars. He would buy the used cars through brokers, and then he would sell them at his used car dealership. That's not unusual to do, quite common to do. Well, there was this one car he sold. It had like about 25,000 miles on it, and he sold it to an older lady. He sold it as a car of a certain year with a certain lower mileage. It had pretty low mileage for that year. And he sold it that way. Well, she drove it for a couple of weeks and the car broke down. And so she took it to a garage where some people she always taken her cars to. She took it to them and she said, "Can you find out what's going on here?" And they look under and they look all around and they said, "Lady, this car doesn't have any 25,000 miles on it. This car's got easily 100, 150,000. It is just a wreck underneath. And, oh, by the way, the odometer had been tinkered. It had been reset back." Well, she sued the car dealer, the used car dealer. And he said, "This isn't me. I didn't do this. I got the title with this mileage on it, and I sold it like that. My actual knowledge, I did not defraud her. She needs to sue the broker who sold her the car, who sold me the car. And I'll even help her do that." So in court, he lost. Why? Because law is not based upon actual knowledge. It's based upon constructive knowledge. It's not what you actually know. It's what you could have known based upon your education, experience, and your representations. It's not what you actually know. Don't play that. I had so many of my clients were trying to break the law, and I would say, "You can't do that." And they would say, "Well, I've never heard of that law. I don't know anything about that." And that doesn't fly. It doesn't matter whether you actually know or not. You could know because you said you knew. You pretended you knew. You put up a sign that said you knew all about this. And then suddenly you're claiming ignorance. Doesn't work. You remember that in business. Constructive knowledge is the standard by which you will be judged in a court of law. And therefore, it is the standard by which you should act in your representations in a business. "Well, I really don't know much about this, but, you know, I'll just pretend I do." Don't do that, because they will hold you to what you represent that you can do, not to what you actually can do. So here's where the law impacts on you. Be cautious, though. The law is a pale version of ethical action. You know, I have to take an exam every year to continue teaching. It's an ethics exam. The ethics exam tests me on law, which is hilarious because the law does not address ethics. It addresses what they think ethics should be or ethical action could be. But ethics goes beyond the law. But I want to point it out right now. The constructive knowledge is the standard by which you will be judged in your actions. Another one that needs to be known right now. Vicarious liability. If you are the principal of an enterprise, the people working under you are the agents. They are there to work for you. If one of those agents does wrong, commits a tort or a crime at work or under the auspices of work, the principals are held responsible. I'll give you a good example of this. And this one, again, is one that I thought I used as a hilarious but not real example, and I found out it was. There was a bar, a tavern. Now, there's your first clue that something's going to go wrong. In West Virginia, there's number two. And at this tavern, it was actually very popular in the area because there was one of the bartenders was a master knife thrower. And every night he would do a little entertainment throwing knives at targets and outstanding at it. He was just a bartender there, and of course the owners of the bar made a lot more money because a guy like him brought in the crowd. Okay, well one night while he was, he did his knife throwing, and this old guy, a drunkard, walked right in front of a knife as it was thrown, and it went into his eye. Now, this was a tough old bastard. He got back in his truck and he drove himself to the emergency room at the local hospital with a knife sticking out of his face. And the lady at the desk didn't even look up. She said, "Sign in, take a number," and he just yelled at her, "Lady, ask me if this hurts." So she looked up and saw the knife sticking out of his eye, and she went to a happy place right away, and all that. Well, he sued the bar, the tavern, and the owner said, "No, you don't sue us. It was the bartender who did that, not us. We didn't do that. Come on." And of course, the court said, "No, you are the principals. You carry vicarious liability. You are responsible for the actions of your agents. You are. Now, you can fire him. You might be able to sue him, whatever. But you had actual knowledge. You didn't even have constructive. You actually knew he did this demonstration every night. So don't play like, well, this was out of our control. We had nothing to do with this. As a matter of fact, we probably have it in policy here in the employee's manual. You don't throw knives." Well, it wouldn't even matter if you had it in your policy. You were still letting it go on. And therefore, anything you had in your policy contrary to that is invalid to use as a point of reference in a court action because you knew that it was going on. You allowed the violation of your policy to continue. Therefore, you are on the hook. What I'm doing here is I'm taking you down from the fuzzy nonsense. No, I shouldn't say that. No, the fuzziness of these ethical theories and ethical models. I'm taking you down to the actionable consequences of non-ethical action. That's what this is all about in this two-part lecture, is do it right and then you don't have a problem with a lot of the problems that would otherwise arise. Clearly, in this case, there was a dangerous situation that was being allowed to happen. Should that have happened? Should they have allowed that dangerous situation to happen? The answer is no. Not because it was dangerous, but because the owners could be held accountable and they could lose a lot of money for letting it go on. So in other words, we're going down to finance. Liquidate all of the costs to dollars, and then you've got the answer to a lot of your ethical questions. Right there, you've got your answer in actual dollars and cents. No, you shouldn't have done that. And you will not do that in the future. That's why you have companies get really, really tough about behavior of their employees in the workplace. And it's even worse now than it used to be. I mean, it is just really harsh out there what they expect of you and what you can do and what you can't do. I mean, you don't mess around with these. That's why sometimes I come off as an asshole to you, as I'm trying to get you ready for a world where these companies know that if they let something keep going on, eventually they are going to get burned. Google had a culture of misogynistic sexism that finally is exploding in their faces in class action suits that are going to cost Google a severe amount of money. Why? Because they can't claim they didn't know what was going on. They're just going to pay money regardless. And they are going to be put under very bad constraints on future actions by courts and by unions probably in the long run too. So it doesn't come down to whether we should do this or shouldn't do this because it's ethical or non-ethical. It comes down to cash money. And again, I'm trying to bring this down to this funnel, in this funnel, to the point where you see that this isn't just fuzzy talk. This is real life. And in the next lecture, I'm going to take you through the other part of this where we get this down to a framework in what's called the agency dilemma. And that'll be on Friday. You have a quiz to take right now. That's all I have for you today. I thank you.